just a while. Let's open the meeting up to questions from the floor. There are monitors scattered around. There are microphones. Just stand up, approach the microphones, and I'll give you an evasive answer. Yes.
Mr. Cab, you have spoken at many other schools and institutions. What is the difference between a school such as ours and an Ivy League college?
About $1,000 in my fee. I'll tell you, I charge Ivy League colleges $1,000 more for combat pay. Students at colleges like yours are so badly educated that when you dissent with a speaker, you simply stand up and dissent. You don't use the new Ivy League methods of beating the speaker up. That's why I charge them more. It's Medicare doesn't handle everything. Yes?
Are you for or against the student campaign to make four-letter words accepted in schools?
Am I for or against the student campaign to make what accepted?
Four-letter words accepted
four
in schools.
Four-letter words accepted in school, yes. Now that it's illegal to use a three-letter word in school, such as God, certainly we should fight to have four-letter words used.
Recently, a Washington columnist wrote that we are in danger of having a guaranteed national income. What do you feel about that policy?
Now, they don't mean, and nobody means, in discussing the guaranteed annual income. We don't mean by poor those who are infirm, infants, and the helpless. What we mean is that great mass of the able-bodied who... don't get outdoors much, except to the welfare office once a week. That's the poor, that great mass of militant, angry, demonstrating, marching, rioting poor. If we had only had the guaranteed annual income will save us so much misery. Just think, if Tom Edison, in his day, they'd had the guaranteed annual income, that poor kid wouldn't have had to go through the misery of staying up nights and figuring out those little gadgets, such as the electric light and the motion picture, to make a buck. He'd have been able to just loaf around New Jersey there and not go through that misery in his little invention shop. Arthur Miller wouldn't have had to go through the misery of writing The Death of a Salesman if there had been a guaranteed annual income. Jonas Salk could have hung around a drugstore instead of providing miracle drugs to be sold inside of it if there'd been a guaranteed annual income. I wouldn't have had to sweat blood trying to figure out little Abner if I, on my mother's kitchen table after the supper dishes were cleared, assuming we'd had any supper that night, I wouldn't have had to go through that misery if I'd had a guaranteed annual income. I tell you, it's the guaranteed annual income that probably was the last law they passed in Rome.
Mr. Cap, earlier in the evening, you commented on Little Orphan Annie. Would you comment on the social and political philosophy of that comic strip?
The social and political philosophy of Little Orphan Annie is possibly the direct opposite of the social and political philosophy of Stokely Carmichael. Neither of them entertained me very much. Although you do notice a resemblance in their hairdos. I will not say an ungallant word about Orphan Annie. After all, she's 76 years old, that child. But, you know, she's been getting away with this thing about Daddy Warbucks being her uncle. No, that's the way they check into motels. And you think she's a child. You know, she wears that dress underneath. Wow!
what do you think of sensitivity training? This isn't being done at colleges yet.
Now, what is it called? Sensitivity training.
It isn't being done at colleges yet. It's being done in students' home, and this involves students disrobing and discovering their sensitivity to each other by contact.
They call that sensitivity training now. Yes, but the old word for it was orgy, of course. Your mayor has just informed me that you have a city ordinance against it. What kind of... What do you do Saturday nights, for heaven's sakes? Sensitivity training, is it? Can you imagine a couple, about 27 of them, up in front of a judge and saying we were conducting a class?
In the December 1966 issue of Playboy, you expressed the opinion that you have more respect and rather prefer the 18-year-old who is in the search for the dollar than the 18-year-old who's a humanitarian. You also expressed some ideas about the term humanitarian. Would you care to comment on that?
Yes, you show me an 18-year-old kid who hasn't been in the world long enough to prove he can do one damn thing for it, and who wants to change a world he's neither contributed to or knows anything about. You show me a humanitarian like that, and I'll show you a pest. You show me a kid, though, who is motivated by the noblest emotion that can grip a man, avarice. You show me a kid who is motivated by avarice, and I'll show you a kid who's going to do something useful for society because it's the only way he can get rich. Yes.
Some people would put the Peace Corps on an institutional level as a folk hero, but you and Little Abner seem to have been taking pot shots at it recently. Do you disagree with it in principle or just in the way in which it is done?
Let me tell you this, the background for my disenchantment with the Peace Corps. In its beginnings, I, like everyone else who adored Jack Kennedy and acclaimed everything he did, I felt that the Peace Corps was possibly not only his greatest achievement, but one of the great achievements of our time. It gave us another look at what young Americans were: selfless, giving, ungreedy, willing to help. It was an inspiring idea. I was so proud of the Peace Corps. I was so proud of being one of those as a citizen who was involved in it. Now, I was in Peru last summer, and Peru is a great place to visit if you're an Inca who was slaughtered by Pizarro 400 years ago. But if you've got any more interest in life in you than that, it's so dull that you'll talk to Peace Corps volunteers, and I did. Big, broad-shouldered kid came up to me, 20, 21, and asked me if I was Al Capp. Everybody else in the room was an Indian, and so I... And he said he was a Peace Corps volunteer. I didn't leave. I said, sit down. And I said, what led you to join the Peace Corps? And he said, just before I graduated from college, I read an article about the squalor and misery and neglect of the Peruvian Indian. He says, I couldn't bear it, and so when I graduated, I came here to Peru to help the Peruvian Indian. And I said, where did you come from? He said, Tulsa. So I said, well, now, look here. If you're really, really concerned about the bringing some kind of help to Indians in need and squalor and Indians who have been neglected, you didn't have to come halfway across the world to find them.
a bus ride from where you live, there are tens of thousands of them. I said, what is so unattractive about the misery and plight of the American Indian that you have to come 4,000 miles to help Peruvian Indians? And he said, I guess I wanted to take a trip. Now, this is what I say about the Peace Corps. The Peace Corps, to me, in a time when pockets of misery and want in this country are so desperate that they explode. What the hell are we doing sending young men and millions to other countries? We need them here. I say, the Peace Corps to me is a man in the corner saloon saying, drinks for everybody, on me, while his own children are home crying for milk.
I would reply to that as an ex-Peace Corps volunteer, that as a mountain woman who uses a corncob pipe has said before on a certain Sunday comic strip, it doesn't make any difference whether their eyes are square or they're round. They are human beings. Wherever they are over the world, they need help. We certainly need to help our people here. I need to help my people here. But it's a world
thing.
Why
not end with that? I need to help my people here. When we have helped our people here, then with good heart and good conscience and good intentions, we can then help our neighbors.
Well, I guess I don't think in the same terms as you do then.
No, you don't. I think in American terms.
I think in terms of humanity as a whole.
Now, you say you think in terms of humanity. I'll give you a startling thought. I think Americans are just as human as anyone else.
Mr. Cap, do you think our professors should be able to censor our readings?
Professors censor your readings? Certainly not. Who the hell do they think they are? Why, they have delusions of power. They think that you go to college to listen to them. Wow. Let them learn the facts of life from you, children.
Mr. Cap, I have a quote here from L. Mendel Rivers, who's the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. He says the cartoonists who disseminate unfair and untruthful information in cartoons are engaged in a conscious effort to give aid and comfort to the enemy. Would you care to comment on that?
He's entirely right, except that no cartoonist disseminates harmful or misleading information. It happens that we are all honest, straightforward, and truthful. And I wish I could say the same for Congress.
Do you think that there are enough safeguards built into the Constitution and the laws by which we govern ourselves for young people and old alike to use these means that have been traditional in the United States for many years rather than to go into riots and draft card burnings and things of this nature?
Well, that's one of the clearest, most concise summings up of the rights of the Constitution I've ever heard. However, there is one amendment that needs teeth, because it isn't working, and that is the 14th Amendment. And that is the amendment outlawing involuntary servitude, because we have not outlawed involuntary servitude in this country. For instance, any man on welfare can refuse any job which he deems not commensurate, not with his ability, but with his taste. That you cannot force any man to work at any job which he doesn't want to work at. And yet, every one of us who do work are forced to support that man. That is, I submit, involuntary servitude. And until we do something to protect the forgotten American. The forgotten American is the guy who makes 7,000 bucks a year, whose kids work during the summer to get through college, and whose kids go to Vietnam without whining, even though they hate war. That's the forgotten man. This man has no right to arrest or complain about the man who rapes his child or who mugs him on the street. He has no damned right to not support the bum who lies down on his fanny and won't work. This is the man the nation has forgotten, and it's time we remembered him because he's the strength of the nation. Many of you here have asked me if I have any secret pitch in Lil Abner. Is there anything I say in it underneath what I seem to be saying? And curious enough, that was a question that began being asked cartoonists about 15 years ago. They discovered a half a dozen guys around this country sitting around in their squalid studios with nothing to guide them except fear of their wives and a sense of self-preservation, who reached more Americans more continuously over a greater period of year, who had earned and kept their trust and affection longer than any product of any network or film studio. Half a dozen of them. And they grew scared, and they began asking us questions. We were subjected, all of us, to inquisitions from every type of inquisitorial group, from our local PTA. At least that night, they weren't out torturing teachers. To full dress, senatorial stuff in Washington. Senators rushed back from investigating poverty at the Folies Bergère just to ask us questions. And the questions were always the same. There were a few general things, and finally came the question every group asked. The question was, do you, who have so much of the trust and confidence and attention of so many Americans over such a long period, do you use this to sneak in a pitch underneath what you seem to be doing? Well, now, for my contemporaries, certainly not guilty is the answer. Certainly, Chick Young, who does Blondie, has no secret pitch. He openly and frankly has been warning Americans for 45 years of the perils of suburban marriage. He has spent his whole life trying to discourage it. He hasn't had any luck, but he's still trying. Nothing secret about him. Alan Saunders, who does Mary Worth, has a perfectly open pitch, and that is, don't ever let a nosy old hag like Mary Worth mess up your romance. He's made his meaning perfectly clear. Nothing secret about it. Dick Tracy, Chester Gould, openly and clearly has just one purpose in mind. That's to scare the hell out of everybody. Has no secret pitch, but for myself, I must plead guilty. I do indeed have one. And to tell you about it, I must tell you that I was born in New Haven, Connecticut, on a street called Stevens Street. Now, Stevens Street wasn't the most undesirable street in New Haven. It was simply the least desirable section of the least desirable area in town. But Stevens Street wasn't one of these hopelessly submerged streets. Stevens Street aspired to become a slum. Now, there are many differences between us on Stevens Street, but we all had one great burning ambition in common, and that was to get the hell out of Stevens. That brought us together. Now, there were tiny differences between us. For instance, we Kaplan kids, Kaplan was my maiden name, we Kaplan kids noticed that the Hogan boys, who lived upstairs, went to synagogue one day late. We noticed that. But we didn't think it made any real difference between us because They seem to come back with exactly the same message that we got when we went on the proper day. Now, we noticed another thing. We noticed that the spiritual leader of the Hogan family, Rabbi McGovern, although he was a very neat little fella, we noticed, young as we were, that he frequently forgot to wear a necktie. We noticed that. Whereas we knew that the bearded patriarch, who was our spiritual leader, Father Gaberski, we knew he wore a necktie because we'd seen him now and then in a stiff wind. However, actually, they were exactly the same kind of guy, basically, and so we didn't feel there was any difference between them. Well, things improved with the Kaplan family, and we moved away from Stephen Street to a better neighborhood where the kids were better informed. And those kids smartened us up. They told us that the differences between us on Stephen Street were not tiny differences at all. They told us that these differences were big enough and important enough to make it okay for anyone who was different from anyone else to kick them around, to persecute them, and to restrict them. Now, if there's any pitch I have, which I'll sneak in shamelessly as often as I can, it's simply this. It's to get back to Stephen Street. Thank you for having me.